out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 9th of May, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at Radio Arian. And I'm very pleased to say we've got rather a legendary figure with us today in British nationalism, someone who's been involved in nationalism for 50 years. He runs the White Voice online PDF magazine, and he's been involved in the National Front and the BNP and all sorts over the years. And his name is Edmund Morrison. Edmund, how are you doing today?
Oh, fine, Sven. Nice to hear from you. 50 years. When you say I'm a legendary figure, so was Robin Hood, but I'm not sure he existed. As I say, it's a long story. Perhaps just highlights from it, or what advice maybe I can give her. Or you fire away with your questions.
Well, how did you first get interested in nationalism in the first place, and what was the first sort of bit of activism that you got involved with, the first group that you got involved with?
Well, that was the National Front. Before the National Front was formed in 67, as you may know, or certainly some of your listeners will know, and I was a founder member. I went to the founding conference, but I'd been in touch with the British National Party of John Bean, which we call the first incarnation. Sounds like we're Buddhist, doesn't it? And I was in the RAF at the time, and they made it pretty clear that I couldn't be in a political party and in the RAF, so I resigned my commission and came out. I was just as I turned 18. I wrote off to John Bean at the old BNP address, and I got a letter back with National Front headline, letter heading, and John said, we're all now amalgamating to the National Front. Would you like to come to a meeting a week on Saturday at the Conway Hall, which is where I went down to and signed up then.
Well, they must have been really pleased to have someone from the RAF joining.
Sorry?
They must have been really pleased to have somebody from the RAF joining them.
Well, yeah, not that I was an air commodore or anything. I was only a pilot officer.
That still seems pretty impressive to me.
Well, one of the things actually that made me realise I couldn't stay in the services and be patriotic to my race was that the rumour was going around, it was semi-official, that we were going to bomb Rhodesia, which, as you probably know at that time, was under sanctions. And I said, whoa, if I'm not going to take part in any operations against white folk in Rhodesia. This was when they declared UDI, and Wilson put an embargo on everything. And then it got down to airstrike, so I had to go see the air commodore over our old base and explain it to him, and he said, well, he understood, he couldn't talk me out of it, and that's what I did. So I actually think I did it on principle.
That's very, very noble of you. Were you awoke to what happened in the war and the fact we were really on the wrong side in the war? Did you know much about National Socialism at this time?
No, I didn't know about the two things, really. The people's net, the tribe of people we put in brackets these days, and the real realities of the Second World War. But from a very early age, my father was a soldier really a career soldier. All my uncles were career soldiers, so it was slam dunk that I was going to go into the services. But as a result of that, I had read military history for a long, long time, right? Way back when I was 8, 9 years old, I started reading pretty heavy books, actually. So I was pretty, I knew what had gone on in World War II, and whether it's the British love of the underdog or whatever, but I remember feeling terribly sorry for the Germans, and maybe that was a spark, but when I came out, I give it some hard thinking. I got some more literature just before I went down to the NF founding conference, and I was then a British nationalist. I recognised I was a British nationalist, at least, anyway. Probably not a white nationalist as I am now, but I'm certainly a British nationalist.
Well, what happened at the conference? Did you meet Colin Jordan? Was Colin Jordan around at the time?
That was one of the great tragedies of the National Front, that A.K. Chesterton stood his ground and wouldn't allow Colin Jordan, our British movement, which had just been constituted in, I think, 1966. So the Greater Britain movement had split off, and Chesterton put his foot down and said no, Colin wasn't going to be allowed in. But and John Tyndall would be after a year's probation, but Greater Britain movement members could join immediately, which Martin Webster did, Dennis Perry, some real old fighters. But I still consider it, even now, all these decades later, a sad mistake that we didn't let see Colin Jordan in, because he was a marvellous speaker and a good organiser. I think the NF lost something there.
Yeah, that's a great shame. Well, it must have been good for you to finally be in the company of other nationalists. That must have helped educate you with things, I would have thought.
It was the first time I'd ever seen any Reds. Who were 62 Group Searchlight at that time, plus a variety of international socialists, which is now the SWP. And I didn't realise what opposition was, to be honest with you. I just walked through them. And a part way through the meeting, it's a famous thing that happened at that meeting, is the Reds took an hatchet to the fuse box for the lights in Conway Hall, and we held the second part of the meeting in semi-darkness.
It's a shame they didn't electrocute themselves.
Yeah, well, I wish they had it. It must have been a rubber handle. But that was my first thought. This is a little bit different than what I expected. You know, there's a possibility of violence and opposition here, you know. So actually, that got me even more interested.
Yeah, I bet it did. I mean, that must have been a real shock to see just what the opposition, what lengths the opposition were prepared to go through just to shut down nationalists speaking to one another.
Yeah, there was no physical attacks. I mean, there were about 200 nationalists from many different groups, BNP, League of Empire Loyalists, Great Britain Movement, Preservation Society, Immigration Control Association. I could go on. There was lots and lots of groups there, much like we have today, unfortunately, Sven. It's a real potpourri.
Well, what happened? What happened after that? Then did you? What position did you have in the newly formed National Front?
Well, the NF, the National Front, was very, very weak in Yorkshire. There was a small BNP unit led by the late Phil Stone, absolutely great nationalist. He died many years ago, unfortunately. And I arranged to meet Phil and his two brothers. So that meant there were four members in Leeds. There was a few members in Sheffield, and there was one other member in Harrogate, and that was Andrew Bronze. And Andrew had been a founder member as well. And he was the first person I ever met, really, on a one-to-one basis. As we didn't know each other. We met in Leeds City Centre. He was 19, I was 18. He was still doing his university degree, and we went off leafleting together. And I reminded of him at the Blackpool Britannia event last Saturday, and he went, "Do you know, Eddie?" He says, "And in all that time, we've never had a crossword." I said, "Well, that says something, doesn't it?"
Well, that's the thing with nationalism, isn't it? With nationalists, you know, we've all got something in common, and we're all fighting to preserve our race. So when did you become aware of the racial aspect and the fact that these other white nations, the same thing is happening to all of them as was happening to Britain?
Well, very quickly, I mean, I ordered no... at that time, there was a book... Just bear with me a second, I'm trying to recall. Yeah, there was a book publishing company called Britain's Publishing. You may have heard, you may not have heard, I don't know. But Britain's Publishing Company was started in the 1930s, connected to the International Fascist League, I think. But they kept publishing, and I bought stacks of books on them. I got Bolshevism is Jewish, and lots of other stuff about race. Now, I'd got in touch with the Northern League, which was run by John Peacock at that time. I got stacks and stacks of books on race, and I read voraciously until I got really clued up. One of my big mentors, big in both ways, I should say, was Martin Webster, because Martin sort of... took me under his wing, not in a physical way, of course, took me under his wing, and it taught me quite a lot, did Martin. He opened my eyes to a worldview, and then I got an inkling that, yeah, I'm a racial nationalist, not just a British nationalist.
And then when did the, the understanding of National Socialism come about? Were you quite talkative about that? Were you openly National Socialist?
I'm a National Socialist. Yeah, there is an article on the Aryan Unity website, which is still extant, which people can read, and it says it's called "From British Nationalist to National Socialist," which explains how I became a National Socialist from a British Nationalist. I do describe myself for the general public as a white nationalist. But I'm not ashamed of saying I'm a National Socialist. I'm quite proud. I always found when the chips are down, when things get really bad, it's always the National Socialists who stand their ground, whether it's physically or ideologically or mentally or what. It always gets down to those hard fighters, those that have that deeper ideology.
Well, I think white nationalism, if you think about it, you think about the things that we need to do for our race to protect us, to preserve us, to increase us, then it's all National Socialist principles because they're all based on natural order.
White nationalism is National Socialism for the 21st century, for various reasons we don't use the term, no reason why we shouldn't, I suppose, but I was with them can drop name with Lady Michelle Renouf last Saturday. Spent a lot of time together, and she said one person and thing. She says, "Eddie, what in Edmund, I should call myself, what in sort of one line could we say our ideology is?" And I said, "Well, Michelle, the way I've always said it in many speeches is this, that white nationalism is the political expression of nature." And she said that is very succinct. It says it in one line. And that's my basis of my ideology, that everything we do is of the natural order. Everything that the left and the opposition do is unnatural. And nature bites them back in the end. And it's just a comfortable feeling to know that what you are as a National Socialist, white nationalist, is basically what nature made you. A fighter, the stronger will out, and pride in your species, your race, your genus, whatever. So it's a big thing having nature outside. Everything that the left produce, such as feminism, is unnatural. It robs women of the right to be women. The gay homosexual thing emasculates men. In fact, everything at the moment emasculates the white male. But it will hit them back if you look at homosexuality. AIDS was nature's way of saying, whoa, you're doing something wrong here, mates. So I think that nature will have something to say about the massive miscegenation that's going on as well.
Oh, it's shocking. It really is shocking. It's interesting you bring up the the emasculation of the white male there. Did that play a role in it? Because it seems to have really sort of taken off today with the MG Tao movement. And, you know, a lot of people are very anti-feminism, and we've got pro men's rights people that are now moving to nationalism. Did that play a role? The fact that, women should be fulfilling their natural role, which is different to men. Did that play as big a part back then as it does now?
Sorry, Sven. I've let you finish. There's two answers to that. If I can answer it as a two-part question. Firstly, in the 1970s, I joined in 67, so I was really active in the early 70s. I was Yorkshire regional organiser by 1972. It didn't come up as a factor about women and men being different, or gays or lesbians being natural, or feminism was just some loonies that appeared on page three with a bra, you know, without the bras on. But so it was a natural order, was accepted. At that time, liberalism, crypto-Marxism, whatever you want to call it, didn't have its grip into the nation in the terrible way it has today. So we didn't really have to sort of justify a lot of things. We concentrated on our policies as being right and normal, which of course they are. But the last 10 to 20 years has seen a shift where this backlash has grown, as you've mentioned, the alt-right in America, the identification movement, Trump getting elected, which I've got mixed feelings about, of course. Certainly Brexit, which was an astounding victory as far as I'm concerned. But these are things we shouldn't have to be proving our masculinity. And by the same token, we shouldn't have our women defending their femininity. It's obvious to, you know, a half-blind child that men and women are different and complementary to each other. Whereas the left loves conflict. It's going back to Marxism, which is based on it will do anything to destroy a healthy nation state and healthy society. So therefore, it brings confrontation. It breeds confrontation. This transgenders and anything that will cause some sort of problem with normal society, it will latch onto like a vampire. They've got no arguments other than equality, equality. They sound like a load of blackbirds repeating themselves. But so it's two parts to that question. First of all, it wasn't an issue. But over the last 20, 30, 20 years, certainly, defending our masculinity has become a prime issue.
It's like they're just trying to blend things together, aren't they? They were trying to blend the races together, encouraging miscegenation, and now they're trying to blend the sexes together. They're trying to tell women that they can do everything that men can do, and they're trying to feminize the men and encourage them to change gender and engage in homosexual acts. And they're pushing this propaganda at an earlier and earlier age, at young children. I mean, the changes in education. I mean, back when you were educated, my guess would be that you were taught about, you probably learned to read Latin. You probably learned a bit about Shakespeare. I mean, nowadays, they just want to program kids into supporting multiculturalism, diversity, equality, all the rest of it. That's their main aim now.
I had a very good education, Sven. I was taught at a Jesuit college. And Latin and Greek were actually two of our basic subjects. And looking back now, they weren't dead languages. There was so much I read or look at that I can see the Latin roots for. But also it gives you a pride in the continuation from the civilization we had then as to what we have now. But as far as the emasculation is concerned, I saw that freedom rally which they had on Saturday in London, and I watched the whole thing through with the speakers from there was Milo Yiannopoulos, there was Tommy Robinson, there was Maria Watson-M from the UKIP spin-off.
Anne-Marie,
every single one of them started their speech, "We are not racist, we condemn fascism and racism." And I thought that They're actually ruining their own arguments the moment they open their mouth. They kowtowing immediately to this suppression of free speech by saying, "Oh, I'm not a racist, but," or "Oh, I'm not a fascist, but," and "We're anti-Nazi, or we're pro-Jewish, but." So these so-called alt-right, and to a certain extent the identificarians, they give in so much to gain so little. They're allowed to say some things as long as they give a lot away. And this is why Griffinism failed in the BNP. Once you start chipping away at your root ideology, you're on a road to nowhere, basically, Sven.
Yeah, I agree. I felt very sorry for Generation Identity. They travelled all the way down from Scotland, which I thought was fantastic. And then they were embarrassed by a drag queen on the stage and Milo Yiannopoulos talking about, you know, interracial buggery. And, you know, I just felt really sorry for them. But at the same time, I thought, you know, that is good of them to have gone there and held the Generation Identity flag there. And I'm sure that lots of people would have been asking them for more information. I mean, they're not extreme. They're not radical, but they're still better than the alt-light, I think.
I completely agree with you there. I've read quite a bit on identity. It's different names in different countries, hasn't it? But it is a grassroots movement of youth, and it's led by some pretty good thinking men and women, boys and girls perhaps even. It was sad that they came all that way to be faced by people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who, by the way, has just got narrowly away from a paedophile, promoting paedophilia on TV. So it just shows you some of the people that are on that platform. But, the identity movement, and even to some extent the alt-right in America, because they have a different feeling about what conservatism is over there. For us, conservatism is just part of the Zog system. For the Americans, conservatism is almost revolutionary. But, you know, they've had so many years of democratic misrule and corruption. And I noticed very noticeable on the Charlottesville march?
Unite the Right in Charlottesville.
Yeah, where they were solidly white nationalist. The slogans they were chanting were white nationalist. The signa they had were white nationalist. And, you know, there was 1 to 2,000 of them. So it shows as a resurgence is not only populist, but the resurgence actually is also happening among the more, I don't like using the word outliners. I'd rather use the word ideologically correct people like us, ourselves. The only thing is Britain seems to be lagging behind every other European country when it comes to it.
Yeah, that's the real shame. I mean, the movement that's really taking off at the moment is Tommy Robinson and Anne-Marie. And we don't really have any racial nationalist movement with the end of the BNP, really. So why don't we take it back to some of the glory days? I mean, there was a time when the National Front looked like they were actually going to get some MPs, and then Margaret Thatcher did the dirty and promised to cut back on immigration. So at that time, there must have been, you know, a large groundswell of nationalism in Britain. I believe there were, Sham 69 as well? I mean, a very popular band that had nationalist sympathies. What can you remember about that time in contrast with today?
Quite a lot that keeps me awake on a night. I can remember some of amusing incidents and some very frightening incidents, actually. You've got to remember that the National Front, which, you know, to give it credit, is still in existence today. In fact, I was talking to Kev Bryan, the National Chairman, yesterday about possibilities of unity again. But I'm keeping that door open, which is a good thing. Going back to some of the activities, you've got the estimate is that over 70,000 people, which is a lot of people, 70,000, at one time or another have held an NF membership card. Now, that's over 50 years. And in the 1970s, by 77, 78, I would reckon we had well towards 30,000 members. The Remembrance Day March in 78, which I was a steward on, had about 3,000 people on it. You know, they were still leaving Victoria Station as the front part was nearing the cenotaph. We had the official Manchester Drum Corps. We had a pipe band there, and there were banners from every NF group you could think of: Birmingham and Cardiff, Edinburgh, Leeds. It was impressive, and I thought, 70. I think if we're marching forward at this rate, we're going to be in power soon. So you can imagine the strength of the march. People say, oh, you're marching on the streets. No, marching on the streets, actually, as long as you've got the people to do it, is the best way to flex your muscles. But there was something quite amusing on that particular march, if I may tell you, Sven.
Yeah, please do.
The Reds had, they were kept fairly in check by the police with it being a Remembrance Day. But the Reds were all dressed in stripy pajamas of the so-called concentration camp victims. And each one was holding up a placard with the name of a concentration camp on: Treblinka and Sobibor and Dachau and Auschwitz. And I shouted across to this red who was holding the sign for Auschwitz. I said, "Auschwitz, mate." And they went, "Yes." I says, "Sorry, we're only going to Victoria." Which the cops absolutely doubled over laughing at, you know. So, but that was the mood of the march. You know, we weren't bothered about them. We were on the move. And as you say, 1 year later, we made a massive mistake standing 356 candidates, I think it was. We lost deposits on every single one of them. And because of Thatcher and the Labour Party directing its, and the Anti-Nazi League can't be dismissed either, the results of the election broke the back of the NF, just as UKIP has been over the last couple of years. And I saw my branch in Yorkshire, Greater Yorkshire, and going from 400 members in 78, which is a lot of members, down to about 40 within 2 years. So it just smashed it.
What do you think was the cause of that? Do you think maybe the National Front should have concentrated its resources on putting less people up for election? And also, what was the role of Labour in that? Because I know about what Margaret Thatcher did, but how did Labour fit into it?
Well, they devoted one or even two, I think it might have been, electoral broadcasts directly at the NF. Nothing to do with Labour Party policy. They had people, you know, high-ranking cabinet members on TV for however long they get, 20 minutes or so. And of course, everybody gathers around for a party political broadcast, and they just attack the NF over and over again. At the same time, the Anti-Nazi League was mounting huge demonstrations, 15 to 20,000 strong in Hyde Park. You know, I mean, that was incredible. But the NF itself did its no favours by each. I remember at the time I was saying to John Tyndall, and by that point, of course, I was a directorate member. I was fairly well known, both to the police and everybody else. But I said we should only put 50 members up, 50 candidates. And he said, "Why?" I said, "Because that will get us a TV party political broadcast, which will bring us lots of members." But I said, "We're spreading ourselves so thin." I said, "Well, I'm standing wards in Leeds. I've got no members to put leaflets out in, you know." But I'm not just blaming John Tyndall this. It was the directorate itself made the decision this is it all out. And we just drained the funds. And worst of all, it wasn't just the votes we lost. It was the morale of the members that plunged. And once that goes down to almost zero, it's a hard job of getting back, Sven.
Yeah. Well, what that shows is that Labour and the Tories worked together to try to de-platform the National Front, exactly the same as it is today, with all the mainstream parties talking about working together to de-platform nationalist parties all over Europe. And again, you've got the so-called anti-establishment, anti-Nazi league that are doing the same, that are on the side of the establishment. I mean, one thing I would say about that, you say that the National Front had 30,000 members in their heyday. Well, we've now got alt-right and nationalist YouTubers that have 30,000 or more subscribers. So even though it's online, you know, the numbers are there again now. We have got those, that sort of numbers again. We just need to transform it off from being online into being offline. Edmund, I've really enjoyed this. I'd really like to get you back on here again as well. Before we go, I know you've got a video company or something as well that I forgot to mention. Do you want to let readers know where they can find you, find your work before we finish?
Yeah, well, I have a video film company that sells a lot of political and historical and Third Reich films, which is, it's valkyriefilms.blogspot.co.uk. And there's a whole list of about 400 films on that for sale. And also there is a White Voice Radio YouTube channel with actually, I've just uploaded the 2004, Spearhead Group inauguration with myself and John Tyndall speaking, which is well worth a look at.
And is White Sentinel Blogspot? That's yours as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course, Nationalist Sentinel. That's been going over, 12 years now. It's got a huge archive of material. That's natsentinel.blogspot.co.uk.
And of course, White Voice as well that you do, and poetry.
Yes, yeah.
you certainly keep yourself active. Anyway, thank you very much for coming on today, Edmund. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.